when he's close to dying, at one point he gathers his disciple and he says, after I die, I know some of you are going to take to the mountains to meditate. Some of you are just going to party with women. And he goes, both types of Zen are fine with me. But if you become a professional cleric and start babbling about the Zen as the way, then you're my enemy.
Danieli Bellelli, thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start off with a quote from a piece called Commencement Speech Bellelli Style. And in this speech you write, without luck, doors will remain closed no matter how much you quote unquote think positively about them opening. So I wanted to ask you, what is your view on luck and how has luck played a role in your life?
I think a little too often we put the accent on, if you just think positively, if you just work hard, if you just do this and that, all magic will happen, doors will open and you'll achieve all the success you want. And I mean, it's not wrong in the sense that, or rather, part of it is not wrong in the sense that without hard work, without discipline, without all that, nothing is going to happen for sure. However, that does not guarantee the outcome at all. That just buys you the lottery ticket. And you still need to win the lottery. And that part, there's luck involved. That part is, you know, I know plenty of people, even successful people, where maybe one inch away from being done because you can only bump against closed doors for so many years before you decide it's time to do something else. And that one meeting, that one day changed things around and they made it. But for each person who had that story, there are probably 10,000 who didn't, who just got slammed down one too many times. Yeah. So I think, I mean, luck is that if you are born in the middle of a plague-infested village today, you're screwed from day one, you know, like the odds that you're going to make it out and have a good life. Is it possible? Sure. Theoretically possible. Is it likely? No. So there is an element. I mean, even if I think about my own trajectory, my own career, I ended up for really no good reason other than luck. I ended up on Rogan's podcast back in 2011 when I didn't even know what podcast were. And then I ended up on his podcast. I mean, that part ending up eight more times is because he must have liked our initial interaction. The audience responded, but
How did the first time happen with Rogan? How did that luck manifest
there's still,
in that way?
Really, no good reason in the sense that like there was Matt Staggs, who was a really nice guy, who was trying to help me out promote a book I had. He regularly tweeted Rogan about news of various kind. And back then, Rogan, of course, his audience was much smaller, so he'd look at things a little more that he received. But, you know, 99% of the time, he didn't reply or take any action on whatever Matt sent him. And this one time, he was like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll book him. And who knows, it was a slow week or who knows what happened, you know, why made him want to go for it? Because... so stuff like that, everything.
Yeah, it was just kind of happenstance on Twitter that he came across it.
And even then, you know, it's like I wrote books that did okay, nothing earth-shattering. I had a podcast for quite a while that did okay, nothing earth-shattering. And then after like 10,000 different tries, like the one thing that really hit, and again, I don't know why, because it's not like is the best thing I've ever done. Like when I started doing History on Fire, that one hit big. So I do feel that there's an element, like a lot of the stories we hear are, there's a survivor bias, you know, the guys who made it, who tell you, it's because I did A, B, and C that everything worked out. And don't get me wrong, them doing A, B, and C helped tremendously. Without them doing A, B, and C, probably nothing would have happened for sure. However, then doing A, B, and C is not enough to guarantee that outcome. There was also an element of you got shuffled the good cards at some point.
Yeah, I used to listen to a lot of podcasts that would fall under the self-improvement category. That's kind of my entrance into podcasting. And there's nothing wrong with those podcasts, but after a while, the way that it usually goes is you're listening to the person that the host identifies as the most successful in that field in particular, the top level person in that field. And after listening to a bunch of episodes in that style, I started to wonder about what about the 10,000 other people who took very similar steps to the people that are appearing on these podcasts, but for whatever reason, energies of the universe, tweets that people saw or didn't see, for whatever reason, the 10,000 other people didn't have a journey that other people would identify as this is the most successful in their field. Still very successful, still doing work that's meaningful. But for me, I started to wonder about the craziness and the beauty of other people's journeys and listening to episodes. I got into a lot of stand-up comedian podcasts, which is how I came across you. Conversations with Joe Rogan, Duncan Trussell, Bert Kreischer. People that tend to take life a little bit less seriously. They still take their work super seriously, but they find the humor in things. And that style of conversation where you're just exploring someone's journey, someone's actions that they took, regardless of the outcome, really took a hold of me, really kind of gripped me. I don't know exactly why, but I just became more and more interested in those types of conversations.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, I feel that as good as sort of this self-empowerment message is telling you to do the things that you need to do to try to get out, there's an element of it that almost feels kind of punishing anybody who, for whatever reason, doesn't make it. Because the implicit message is you screwed up. Had you done the right stuff, you would be super successful and be amazing and make a great living with your passion, this and that. And the reality is the majority of people will never get there. Now, some of them will never get there because they don't work hard enough, because they are not creative enough, because whatever. But there's a good chunk who work hard, who are creative, who even produce amazing stuff, will still not get there. And I think the message is, it's all, there is no such thing as luck. It must be your fault. Mm. This must be something you didn't do. And I'm like, It's not that simple of a story. And to me, it's not an either or, you know. Of course, there is definitely an element of personal responsibility and discipline and hard work, all of that for sure. However, we shouldn't discount the fact that there's also a luck factor involved.
Yeah, it's weird that the conversation about luck is always binary. It's either your career ended up here 100% because of happenstance, or the hard work bootstrap story, which is bullshit in a lot of ways, and you had no help and luck didn't have anything to do with it. There's never, you know, 60% of this was the work and the family I was born into, the people that surrounded me, and maybe 10% of luck and 20% some other things. It's never, there's not a lot of conversations surrounding the nuance of luck. It's always seen as this force that overtakes someone's life, or they just somehow shunned it and did it all on their own.
I think it's really that, like, the virus of the human mind to think in those binary terms, because it's, you know, it applies to this discussion, but it applies to so many discussions that I hear, that I have, that I regularly, people tend to take a partial truth, stretch it to make it the entire truth, discount the fact that there's a partial truth also on another side of the equation, sometime in the opposite direction, and just that's how they run with it. Mm. And so rather than having a more, this is true, but also this is true, and you have to figure out to make these things go together and find the right balance, it's always they find one aspect and run with it. And then and I think it's just easier. I think it's just an easier, it's almost like you don't create a good dogma on nuance, but you do create a good dogma on a simple tale that has a single message with a clear-cut approach. And why do people do it? Because, you know, nobody says I love dogma, but the reality is most people do, is because it's a bulwark against the uncertainty of life. People feel that they have something to fall back on, that is their standard answer to anything that happens. They can fall back on that thing that works some of the time. So then they think it's going to work all of the time and is the sacred thing that can never fail. And, you know, sweet story, but that's not how life works.
Do you ever feel like you've reverse engineer a story from where you are now to make a narrative fit? Because I know that I'll fall into that sometimes where something will, a chain of events will happen. You know, some of it's work, some of it's luck, some of it's people came in at the right time, relationships, things like that, just all these things kind of banging together in the universe and a couple things click and they hold together. And then based on those things that click, I'll kind of see, I'll look behind my shoulder and be like, oh yeah, that's how it all came together. I went from A to B to C and now I'm here, and I kind of have to shake myself out of that. Do you ever kind of reverse engineer your narrative in that respect, how you've ended up here today?
I tend to be very like, can you believe that this happened, more than, oh, of course this was gonna happen kind of thing. I tend to have very wow, I did not see that coming, where it started here, it ended here, that was weird. And
yeah,
it's not like you put me there at square one, I know for sure that I would get back to square D after a while. It's like, no, I feel that there's a lot of chaos surrounding it all. And there's a lot of, and again, you know, it's like, in a way, to me, one of the metaphors that I use the most is surfing, because it kind of reminds me of like, you cannot predict the ocean like it, exactly. I mean, you can predict some general things about tides and things, but, you know, you cannot predict each wave. Each wave is going to do what it wants to do. You have, or you can predict to a tiny degree, but not exactly. And you have to make split-second changes where you are heavily leaning one way. Then you come more to a center balance position. Then you heavily lean the other. And you need to do this thing to actually stay balanced, because it's a... because it's a dynamic balance. It's constantly changing. And so you need to have this full range of answers available to you to be able to stay with it. And the wave does its thing, and you just have to figure out how to ride it.
Yeah, I listen to a music artist named Mike Studd. He just goes by Mike now. And he, like myself, was also a college baseball player. He was much better than me, was a big prospect at a high school, a little older than me. But I found him because he was this college baseball player making music that was going viral. And something that he always spoke about was riding the wave. And he would talk about being on a wave, being just this tiny dot on a wave. And the wave is the culture, the wave is people's preferences, the wave is energy. And you, sometimes he, you know, you fall into thinking that you are the wave, like you're all the things that are pushing it forward, rather than just, I'm doing something that's meaningful to me. And for whatever reason, at that time, it got picked up in the wave, it got swirled up, and now I'm being, you know, carried towards the bright lights of the shore. So, you know, what you said reminded me of that. And I think that's a very useful metaphor, thinking about it as a wave.
Totally. I mean, even just timing. Timing is everything. It's like Matt had sent a tweet a different day, Rogan would have never read it, my whole career changes. Like that. And not that the Rogan thing alone was enough to guarantee everything that happened before. There were many other things that needed to fall into place a certain way, and many others that didn't, that could have changed things also in a very good way. So I feel like, you know, you do the best with the cards that are given to you. You don't just complain about, oh, I've been given terrible cards. It's like, well, yeah, that's how life is. It's not fair. Not everybody gets the same cards. At the same time, you know, you acknowledge the fact that, yeah, cards show up however they show up. And you're, the only thing you can do about it is doing the absolute best with the ones you have in your hands.
Yeah, it's like if you have shitty cards and you're sitting around the poker table and your reaction is to just bitch about the cards in your head and be like, fuck this, like I know this guy's a better hand than me, rather than just fold, maybe you start betting on your ego or bluffing, and it's not out of skill, it's out of just being infuriated by the fact that you have shit cards and you want to get something out of it, and you kind of let your emotions get the better of you, and then, you know, you're fuming, and then the next hand you're dealt is pocket aces, and you're like, oh, okay. Like, yeah. That things can change pretty quickly.
Totally.
For that feeling you were talking about where you prefer to think about it as shock, like being amazed that something can happen. Mm-hmm. What was the last time that happened to you where either, you know, a conversation or watching the sunset, whatever it is, where you're like, holy fuck, you know, I can't believe I'm alive right now. I can't believe this is right in front of me.
I mean, I guess you can get that feeling from
besides seeing my face on the screen, of course.
Right, of course. Clearly. Now, I think it can happen in multiple ways. It can happen both in terms of reflecting on a journey of where you find yourself. It can also happen, like for example, this is a random one, but like at one point for a project that eventually went nowhere, but it looked like it could, I ended up having a meeting with Oliver Stone, who was, he wanted to do a screenplay I wrote and direct it. And I was thinking, how fun is, like, one of the movies that influenced me the most when I was a little kid was Conan the Barbarian, which Oliver Stone wrote or co-wrote. And then I was like, here I am with a story that he likes, that he wants to. I was like, how weird. How the hell did I end up here? You know, it's like, seemed like a very strange journey to get there. And again, that one didn't go anywhere. And that happens too. But like sometime, or, you know, as a kid, I would read Tom Robbins novels, the author of Still Life with Woodpecker and even Cowgirls Got the Blues and kind of stuff. And I love his writing like crazy. And Tom ended up doing a little blurb for one of my books at some point. And I worship the guy. I always thought he was greatest writer ever in terms of fiction. And so things like that where you're like, wow, imagine that somebody told you that this is how it's going to play out. And so there's that. And then there's also just sometimes beauty of nature, places where you find yourself where you're like, this is not real. This is just too beautiful, too amazing, too everything, too be true kind of thing.
Do you mind is there a way to turn your volume up a little bit? It just sounds a little low on my end. Or sit a little bit closer to the laptop. Okay, yeah, that sounds that's perfect. It was just cutting out a little bit at the end. But
you were probably leaning back too much.
That's perfect right there. You were kind of saying you were saying having the opportunity with guys like Tim Robbins, being able to possibly be involved with the movie with Oliver Stone, even though it doesn't play out to the final project, just being able to be in the conversation, that's like a holy shit moment. Like, wow, I can't believe this opportunity is presenting itself.
Yeah, some played out, some didn't, but there's definitely some of those where you're like, huh, how did the hell did I end up here? And then there are the ones that they're just sometimes just life itself, you know, being in nature, being in places where you're like, this is too beautiful to be real kind of feeling. This is just everything seemed to click in the right way at a cosmic level. And you're like, wow, this is amazing. And then there are also all the times when you feel the opposite, right? Where you feel like things seem completely random and chaotic and shitty for no good reason. And it's all part of it.
What's a standout place in nature that's done that for you? Whether it's been one time you've been there or it's a place you consistently go, what's a place that has kind of brought that sense of awe to you?
Couple of places that seem to have that effect on a regular. Hawaii is just, I mean, I'm not saying anything new because everybody feels it. That's why there's a gigantic tourist industry there. Hawaii is the second island.
It's new to me because I've never been. Is there a particular spot in Hawaii that does it, or just going anywhere in the islands?
I mean, I'm almost tempted. It's weird because there are so many islands, and from what I hear, most of them are fantastic. But I've been in Maui the first time, and I almost don't want to go to another island, even though probably they are just as good, if not better, who knows, because it feels so damn good that I'm like, yeah, I don't want any more than this. This is as good as it gets for me.
Yeah.
And you just start relaxing the second you arrive. Like, you arrive, and within minutes, I catch myself going, with this sense of... And Hawaii is more understandable. Lots of people feel that way. One that, if you tell people, doesn't jive the same way. The Black Hills in South Dakota. South Dakota is not exactly a prime tourist destination.
Black Hills in South Dakota.
Yeah, they are amazing. They are mountains, rivers, lakes, crazy nature everywhere, deer all over the place, bison. They are just one of those places that I'm unfailingly blown away by. Every time I'm there, it feels like you're in a Lord of the Rings movie type of scenario. It's so beautiful. And every single time I have that effect.
That sense of relaxation you mentioned, when you're in Hawaii, you kind of instantly relax. I was in the Adirondacks this past weekend doing a backpacking trip with my girlfriend. And I was sitting in the tent at, we're camping at around 3,500 feet, and we're the highest campsite on that loop. And it was so quiet and peaceful at night, right before we were getting ready to go in and close the tent. It was so quiet that it was almost making me restless, because I live in Brooklyn. There are noises going on right outside that you can't hear because the mic is very directional, but like, there's construction, there's car horns, there's, people yelling on the street for all sorts of reasons. And being in that quietness for a night or two, it was weird that there wasn't any noise. And then, after 30, 40 minutes, I was like, wow, this is a way that gets you thinking in a certain, it's a state that gets you thinking in a certain way that wouldn't be possible in the city. And I'm not saying anything new either. It's just an experience that was recent for me, but I found myself connecting dots and being able to let go and thinking about things that normally don't cross my mind on a work day in Brooklyn, or even an off day, just walking around the city, just being in nature, feeling small as fuck, being surrounded by black bears and trees, and just like climbing cliffs and looking down and being like, wow, nature, this mountain doesn't give a shit about me. I could just like trip and go over the side, and this will not even be a fleck on the history of this mountain. Like, I'll just be a corpse rotting that will be gone after a few years. And in a way it's very calming and soothing.
Yeah, it's trippy. I had that experience a little over 2 years ago, because I moved, I was living in Los Angeles, and then I moved outside of LA, maybe an hour and a half out. And that was the first thing I noticed, was how quiet it was. Like, I did not hear the constant buzzing that was background noise in the city that you don't even pay attention to after a while, because it's so constant that it's just white noise in the background. But not hearing it, I was like, wow, this is crazy.
In the city, car horns are like putting on a white noise machine. It's like some people put on a fan to sleep. You're just... listening to drunk arguments, someone, fucking yelling drunk at the top of their lungs. And some nights, when I was younger, I was that guy that was 22, just like yelling at my friend, leaving in the Uber, like, I'll meet you back at your, and like everyone else is trying to get some sleep. But yeah, I love the city, but it's also, you just don't realize how much it affects,
it does.
The ability to even think about certain things. It's wild.
Yeah, I find myself regularly working better at night when everybody started unwinding, because I just would, both in terms of physical noise, and who knows, maybe I picked up on something else, but there was just too much energy going on, too much noise, too much stuff, too much background distraction that really affected my thinking. And I noticed that I was much better at night when after everybody settled down or going to sleep or something. That's when my mind would function best. In a place like this, that is like this 24 hours a day, it's so much easier to do it any time of the day, to have that kind of clarity. And that makes all the difference. That really does. Where you live will affect how you think, how you feel. It doesn't determine it, because, of course, you can have two people living next door to each other and they will have radically different emotions, outlooks, and everything, but it influences. It certainly gives you a push in a certain direction.
So if the noise and the environment is constant, but let's say you're doing something creative in the morning and at night. So you go, you're writing in the morning for a week straight, and then you're writing at night for a week straight. Do you find that you have a different energy or style based on the time of day when everything else stays constant, or is it very similar?
Yeah, 100%. I'm more of a night person. I just, I wake up in the evening, you know, 6, 7 p.m. is when I'm like, oh, now life makes more sense. And everything starts. More mornings are all right, you know, I can function, but also because I tend to work later in the night, I tend to sleep in the morning. So when I wake up, I'm good. I'm mostly functional and stuff. Usually after lunch, I have a break for a while where my functioning is not at its best, from like 1 or 2 p.m. through 4 or 5, and then slowly start climbing up again.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what it is, but I find that when I'm recording podcasts at different times, and I'll go weeks where I'm just doing it in the morning, and then maybe I have 4 or 5 guests that are across the other side of the world because of time differences. So it's my night, their morning. And sometimes I'm drinking, you know, different substances. Maybe I'll have some whiskey. Maybe I'll smoke a little bit before a night podcast. But even when I'm just drinking tea or something, I feel like my brain is working differently at night. And I don't know why. Like, literally, you know, the sun's down. Maybe that has something to do with it. My energy levels are a little more calm. So I've thought that, like, maybe the calmness of my energy lets the ideas that maybe I'm too scared to explore during the day come out at night. Like when that kind of energy buzz, that, you know, 10 a.m. energy buzz goes away, you're almost, it's like you're too tired to reject the ideas that you were too scared to say. And then they just come out on a night podcast sometimes. And, you know, over time I've learned to have that same feeling even in the morning as well. I've found like I've had, there's something there that's different.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
So I want to get into your fantastic kick-ass podcast, History on Fire. And in specifically the series on Ikkyu Sojin.
Oh, yeah.
And you dedicated 2 episodes to the unconventional life of Ikkyu Sojin. For the first episode, titled Sex, Zaki, and Zen, you actually shared an image of Ikkyu Sojin drinking wine off of a lady's boob. And after listening to the episode, that is a perfect way to depict the release of his story. So I wanted to ask you, for people who may not have heard of Ikkyu, who is Ikkyu Sojin and what makes him one of your all-time idols?
So Ikkyu was born at the end of the 1300s in Japan. He was almost certainly he was the legitimate son of the Emperor of Japan. However, because he was illegitimate, he ended up his mom was a little worried that they may try to get rid of him because she was getting pushed off court. So she put him in a Zen monastery when he was 5. Which, you know, kind of a hard life. You're a little kid. You are completely estranged from your dad. You are essentially also estranged from your mom, since she puts you in a monastery and only you get to see her once in a while. Monasteries, they're not exactly the most cheerful place for a little kid to grow up in. So, you know, he has his struggles. And the funny thing about him is that he has clearly an incredible grasp of Zen Buddhism, but because he has such an incredible grasp of Zen, he tends to clash with the Zen establishment, because he feels that they had turned Zen into a bureaucracy, they had turned it into this thing that was lifeless, and in some way the opposite of what Zen is supposed to be. So he regularly clashed with them, and eventually he just flat out broke with a lot of the Zen hierarchy and became a wandering teacher where he would teach about his way of life, the humongous effect on the cultural history of Japan, since many of his disciples played a key role in the development of many Japanese arts. And just had a blast of a life. You know, his passions were in no particular order: Zen, women, and drinking. And, you know, some of it sound provocative, but some of it was just, his approach was like, look, Zen at its roots, Zen is a way of perceiving reality. It's a way of being. It's a presence. So doing Zen is not just sitting cross-legged with clouds of incense in a monastery. That's just the stereotype. It's like you saying you can have a certain degree of consciousness in anything you do. And as long as you're not a dick about it, as long as you behave semi-decently, it's not what you do that makes you or doesn't make you spiritual. It's the attitude you bring to things. And he's just funny. Like, so much of his stuff is just hilarious because he's defying social conventions, but without the teenage edginess of the guy who's trying to prove how different he is, more just because he feels some social conventions are stifled and needlessly rigid. So
I was going to say that one of the funny moments from the podcast was him burning the Certificate of Enlightenment.
Sure.
And just basically like taking this piece of paper that in a lot of ways is like a college degree. You know, you spend a lot of energy, time, and money trying to achieve this thing that ultimately is a piece of paper that you present at the first job you have, and then after that, like, no one gives a shit. You know, college is all about the friends and relationships. That's basically the only thing that is lasting and meaningful from it. And you learn things as well. You have great professors, great teachers, but the actual certificate is not super meaningful. And then listening to the moment where EQ basically just fucking lights this certificate on fire that all his you know, for lack of a better word, classmates, monk mates, I'm not sure the exact term for it, but they're just like, what is this guy doing? Like, I would die for this thing that he's just burning right in front of me, and just walks out like it's nothing. To me, I was like, wow, this dude, it would have been a wild, like a wild sort of wisdom to be around this guy.
Yeah. And the thing that, one of the reasons why I enjoy doing the two episodes about him is because so often history is a history of warfare and bloodshed, and many of the people I pick, even though they may be wonderful human beings in some way, they are usually highly disturbed characters in one way or another. There's something that is a breath of fresh air, because he's a guy who just enjoyed life. There's not that, I mean, he goes through stuff early on, but eventually he gets to a point where there really is not much drama. You know, usually you don't make a podcast about just somebody who enjoys life, because it doesn't feel like there's a story to tell. So many of our stories are built on conflict. But he's something else, because he can make you feel like you're listening to an extremely exciting life, even though there are, you know, no battles, no bloodshed, none of the classic things that people tend to focus on. And so it's a healthy reminder that sometimes an intense and beautiful life doesn't have to be all about drama. And I love that. I think that's one of the best lessons that one can get from it, is really just the ability of the guy to have a great life.
Yeah, and some of it is shock and awe with some of the stories that he tells about brothels and hanging out at bars, and he has some very sexual poetry And it's also very practical. And it made me think about my own upbringing in the Catholic Church. You're going to church every Sunday. You're basically hardwired with this instilled guilt for anything that's considered a sin. Sure. Which is, you know, like if you or anyone's hand gets within 2 inches of a private part, you know, you can't even smell alcohol, like all this like super intense guilt that you don't really know where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And I also went to Catholic high school too. So it's just like constantly. And, you know, once I became a teenager, once I'm, you know, hooking up with people, drinking, like actually being a human being, there was something in my mind that was going, yeah, I think, like, I don't think this is wrong. I think this is, you know, I'm learning a lot through these experiences that are quote unquote sinful. And I learn a lot more doing these things than, you know, falling asleep in mass, eating a wafer, and then saying, you know, Hail Mary 10 times because I jerked off the night before, whatever it was. And it's the stories of ICU, going to the brothels and the bars and feeling more mindful, you know, hanging around beautiful women and people that were considered the outcasts of society. That really resonated with me because I haven't gained as much experience as him or yourself, but even as a, you know, 18, 20 year old, I still felt like, yeah, I think there's something that this guilt is fucking up for a lot of people that grew up with at least Catholic religion. I can't speak for people in other religions because I haven't experienced that, but at least Catholicism instills you with a lot of guilt that prevents you from fully enjoying a ton of experiences.
Right. No, certainly. And I think that's one of the greatest terrible things that many ideologies, both religious and not, have instilled in human beings, is a sense of shame over just the basic stuff that makes you human. You know, and it's like, this is not to say, because often what happens is the people who throw away the shackles and reject the shame, they often end up doing it in a way that makes you understand, back to that duality we were talking about, that makes you understand why those rules were put in the first place, because they do it in a shitty, terrible way, often abusive to other people, self-destructive. And you're like, no, that wasn't the idea. You could do certain things without being a dick about it, without being self-destructive, without all that. There's a way, it's not about the actions are terrible or not, is how you do them, the measure in which you do them, how you carry, and that makes all the difference. Like you don't need to be this repressed freak who doesn't dare to look up at something because otherwise it's all going to be sinful and destruction, or be this quote-unquote liberated person who's just on this self-destructive and destructive of others kind of bend. There's a way to be more like freer without becoming an idiot, you know, without it doesn't have to be one crazy extreme or the other crazy extreme. There's a very happy place somewhere in there where you can have the freedom without the stupidity that people sometimes bring to being free.
Yeah, that's a good goal in life, to become a little less of an idiot every day, instead of trying to become a smarter person. Think like, am I as much of an idiot as I was yesterday? Okay, like maybe a little bit less. I'm on the right path.
Yeah, because I mean, how many stories you have heard of the people who are like rejecting some of the traditional repressive bullshit that they grew up in, and the next thing they do, they become like cult leaders who use these sweet lines that make sense to then take advantage of a bunch of people. It's like, it's messed up. No, you can actually reject some stuff without turning into an abusive freak. And
it's like some of those people that reject religion, they're like, you know, I don't like saying words in a synchronous manner with hundreds of people, and I don't like drinking stuff on command, and then they'll leave, and then go start a cult and be like, say these words when I tell you to, and then we're gonna all drink this and kill ourselves. And like, so it is like a funny switch where it's like there are some people that aren't against they're not rebelling against religion. They're just creating a religion that they like better.
Totally. And usually where they are at the top and they gain all the benefits. And
yeah,
it's more of a selfish thing than anything. But I did another episode on this guy, Diogenes, who was a Greek philosopher about 2,400 years ago. And I think it's an interesting comparison to Iccio, because Diogenes is also hilarious, also defies social convention, also does a lot of the stuff that seem very Iccio-like. But there's a big difference that he's great when it comes to criticizing the existing order of things, doesn't seem to be all that great when it comes to creating an alternative that works. Great thing about Iccio is that he does. He has this different way of living that people gravitate to. They are happy. They feel good. He's inspiring to people. He's doing a fantastic job. Diogenes is more like cracking great jokes about why the existing order of things sucks. But then when you look at, like, there's nothing built on, like, destroying a previous oppressive order is great if this gives you freedom to create something beautiful. If you just destroy it for the sake of destroying it, it's like, well, now what? You know, what is that you bring to the table? So that one was an interesting one for me to study, because on one end it was really fascinating. But on the other hand, it also felt like a missed opportunity. It felt like, oh man, the guy's so funny, so this is so that, but where is this going? And it doesn't feel like, in fact, I called it, that episode, I called it the punk rocker of ancient Greece, because he does have this very punk rock vibe to him, which is great in the criticism of the existing order, but not like all punk, but definitely a lot of it.
What was the first word? The bank something of ancient Greece?
I said punk rocker, as in punk rock, the genre.
Oh, punk rocker. Yes, yes. Yeah, no, it's like very punk, rebelling against the power. Would Diogenes be, punk rocker is a way to see it? Do you think he would have been someone who would be a good stand-up comedian today, where he's good at talking shit about power and problems, but a stand-up comedian's value to society isn't providing the solution. It's to make jokes and point out the cracks and kind of like open them up and say funny shit while they're doing it. Do you think he would have been a character like that today?
Definitely. That's exactly what he does. He's great at that, but you also feel like, okay, that's nice, but how about the next step?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there wasn't the job of stand. I guess there were jesters in ancient Greece, like something equivalent to stand up comedian, where your job was to just tell jokes.
Right. I mean, there were people of entertainment that never been lacking, right? So it's like you either did it because you wrote plays and they could be comedies, and that's what you did, whether as an actor or as a writer. They did it probably more informally like that. So there were definitely things that, and Diogenes was a philosopher / just crazy guy on the street, and he was just funny, really funny.
Yeah.
But again, to me, all that intelligence in picking apart the stuff that doesn't work only goes so far if you never bring up stuff, alternatives, if you never offer something else that can work.
Yeah, yeah. If you're pointing out the problem and there's no solution, just you,
right?
It's not as useful.
Yeah.
What do you think the catalyst was in Iccio's life that allowed him to be a guy who rejected the hierarchy, rejected the power structure of Zen Buddhism, but didn't try to go down a degenerate path himself, like you were saying before? What do you think was that spark in his life that allowed him to do his own thing and inspire people to live a certain way, but he wasn't necessarily trying to build another religion, like to build another power dynamic with him at the top?
I think it's just, I don't know that there's one factor. I mean, we would have to know a lot more about his life to determine it, but my guess is that there was no one factor. I think it's a mix of his personality, 10,000 different experiences he went through that shaped him into a person that was different from some of the people who would feel inclined to go down that path.
Mm. Do you have a favorite story or moment from IQ's life that you learned that you enjoy retelling, like something that stands out to you when maybe people who haven't heard about IQ will ask you about him, and something that pops out like, oh, you have to know about this. Like this is like something that really paints a picture of him.
There's a bunch. He's at one point he falls in love with this singer who was blind. And it's one of the most celebrated romance stories in Japanese history. And that happens when IQ's in his 70s, which is pretty fun in itself.
Mm.
When he's close to dying, at one point he gathers his disciple and he says, after I die, I know some of you are going to take to the mountains to meditate. Some of you are just going to party with women. And he goes, both types of Zen are fine with me. But if you become a professional cleric and start babbling about the Zen as the way, then you're my enemy. And I thought it's hilarious, right? Because it's like he's comparing a deep meditation in the mountains and a more sensual life. It's like those are both viable paths, but intellectualizing all these in a bullshit kind of way and, you know, removing it from the reality of what it is, because he's trying to build this castle of ideas, and it's that I would have a problem with. It's funny, you know. It's
it's a great, you know, kind of deathbed passing away proclamation to people in your families. Go have some alone time, go get laid, do both of those, but don't start, you know, spreading around what I said as a religion or something like that. If you're a figure that people looked up to, like, this is what worked for me. Take what you want from it, leave what you want, but like, go have fun, get laid, reflect on your life, and make the world a place where others can do the same.
Definitely. So he's just there are so many. He's a great guy. The story of his life is just fun to listen to.
Yeah. There's a couple quotes I wanted to bring up from the episode. There's one, speaking of going to get laid, he literally says, don't hesitate to get laid. That's wisdom. Sitting around chanting sutras, that's crap. So kind of like the same, don't fucking try to, you know, separate your enlightenment outside of the intensity of life and shit like that. Like, just go do it or do someone and bring your enlightenment to that sexy woman or, you know, whatever, smoking a joint, having sex, drinking a beer, like, just make your enlightenment something that is intertwined with all of that.
Absolutely. He's very big on the not separating the so-called sacred from the so-called profane. Again, to him is how you do things, not so much what you do.
Yeah. So going off of the first part of that quote, don't hesitate to get laid, that's wisdom. Is there a meaningful piece of wisdom that you've learned from getting laid, from your interaction with the ladies?
I think it's like there are few things in life that can put you in the moment, that can press the reset button. People talk, I mean, I've tried to meditate many times, and sometimes I got some benefits out of it, but nothing that was even a tenth of what I would get from good sex, where suddenly everything is reset. I feel like I'm looking at life in a new way afterwards. And I'm just like, really changed my chemistry, changed my brain, changed everything immediately. So I think it's, it's like one of those forces that has that power to, and clearly not for everybody. Like, I hear people who talk about how afterwards they are wiped out or they have no energy or who knows why, whether it's physical or it's because they carry guilt or what it is. But I definitely have heard of people having radically different experiences in that regard. But
have you ever... sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I was in regards to the feeling after finishing from sex. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of the term post nut clarity?
No, I didn't, but it makes sense.
It depends, I think, on the connection that you have to the person, because some people use post nut clarity as with a negative connotation, like you finish and you're sitting there with the girl that you're going to have to spend, you know, the rest of the day with, possibly depending on what time it is, or sleep over. Mm-hmm. And you have this realization like, fuck, I don't really want to be spending time with this person right now, you know, out of having sex. And it's like this clarity moment where all the reality comes rushing back in after the nut, the post nut. And for, you know, for me, I've had those moments, but I also feel like when I've had sex with someone that I have a real connection with, that post nut clarity is much more akin to the mountaintop realization where you're just like, ah, oh, this was nice. Like, that was a good time. You know, do you want to go get something to eat, talk, like conversation, things like that. So that's post nut clarity as a term that people have used. I heard it for the first time in college, where it's just like whatever the reality is with that person, as soon as you finish, it comes rushing back in.
I mean, and it applies to a person, but also applies to me, to just your way of thinking. It's like there's something that happens, probably chemically, where I feel I'm seeing things clearer. I am understanding things better. I'm really, it's like this reset button that got me out of maybe whatever mental funk or being stuck in a mental place for a bit too long. And suddenly I'm like, ah, okay, I can breathe again. This is nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned meditation too. And I was thinking about when I started meditating 4 or 5 years ago. I still do it every morning now, but at the beginning I became hyper obsessed with trying to replicate that state of meditation into other parts of the day. And so at first I started, like, I would tell myself that I needed peace and calm. I needed to recreate that at every point during the day, so I would have that feeling however best I could. And obviously that's impossible. You open your eyes, or sometimes you're meditating with your eyes open, and then the day happens and you're just, I was in a kind of a fiendish rush to recreate that feeling where there's no pressure. And then after a while, I'm like, this is a shitty way. I'm just like giving myself my own guilt trip, kind of like, if I'm not feeling like I'm meditating at every moment, if I'm not feeling like super present, then I'm doing something wrong, rather than just like riding the wave or trying to apply that sense of presence to whatever it is I'm doing, even if it sucks. Like, there's a lot of shit that sucks, obviously, but trying to be present as much as possible. That just, some people stick with meditation, some people don't. I really think it doesn't matter. Whatever makes you feel mindful. And I choose to sit on a pillow. I don't pretend that everyone has to do that or everyone should do that. But when I started to, you know, tell myself this is just like, this is life, but this isn't what you need to recreate, things kind of became much more clear. And that, to me, hearing the episode on IQ with all the contrasts of life and not trying to escape into some temple, not trying to just become enlightened by rejecting the problems of life, that really resonated with me.
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, I've done like 100 episodes or so, and that's probably high up on my list.
Yeah, it's there's another quote, throw me into hell and I'll find a way to enjoy it. I wanted to ask you, is there a specific hell that you've endured that's stood out to you, and how did you find a way to enjoy certain moments of it, or if you found a way to enjoy certain moments?
I mean, what I love about this sentence is the defiance, because that's the reality. It's like, sometime there's nothing you can do. Sometime life dumps in your lap stuff that is hell, that will mess you up, that will tear you apart. And it's not saying, oh, you know, it's not hell. Truly is actually an opportunity for you to grow. No, don't bullshit me. This is hell. This sucks. This is as bad as it gets. However, once you have established that this is hell, having that determination of saying, fuck you, I'm not going to let you squash every joy in life. I love the defiant aspect of it, that willingness to find a way to still leave a tiny room for joy in a horrendous scenario. And it can be, you know, anything from dark humor that allows you to not succumb to the deepest tragedies by being able to even crack a smile, at least for a second. It can be, you know, a lot of things that play that role for me. And I feel that's key. You know, I mean, I've been through a lot of shit. I've been, like, my wife died 11 years ago when my daughter was only a year old. So, you know, I had to raise her on my own. I had, you know, there was a lot of shit that happened. And you know, there was no denying that it was and continued to be hell for long, where it would still hit me physically, mentally, emotionally, and every which way. But trying to find moments, you know, because it's like, that's all you got, right? It's like, okay, maybe I'm not going to solve the problem now. Maybe I'm never going to solve it. And by problem, I mean being able to kind of get through in terms of grief and everything. But I can have this one moment. I can make this one moment good. And then if I'm lucky, I can make the next moment good, or I can make another one tomorrow. Like, just because you're under a wave, not giving up to, oh, this is how things are 24/7, finding little spaces to breathe and inject joy, even when you can't alter the overall situation.
I'm sorry to hear about your wife. I can't begin to imagine what that hell is like. I'm sorry.
I mean, the whole period was insane because, yeah, she died. My daughter was a year and a half old. I had, you know, be there 24/7 for her. My career took a nosedive where, you know, a job that I thought I was building up toward, I realized that it was never going to happen. As a result, we didn't have two incomes anymore, so I couldn't really quite afford the house we were living. So everything was going to shit on multiple levels at the same time, practically as well as emotionally, of course. And interesting enough, that's actually about a few months later, not even a full year later, that's when I ended up on Rogan. So,
oh wow, like,
weirdness of it all.
Was there in that horrific aftermath, was there something that you did in defiance? Like, you were talking about kind of defiance of just saying, fuck it, whatever it is, I'm going to find some semblance of enjoyment. I can't even imagine trying to do that. But in those few months after, was there anything that you could kind of lose yourself in, where you maybe caught yourself enjoying something that you weren't expecting?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because, of course, you do get messed up by things. But I mean, I remember even, I don't know how long after, it was quite a while afterwards, but at some point I remember, you know, I did not have time for anything, right? I was just living and breathing, trying to do a couple of things to make sure that we had some money at least, while at the same time essentially spending all day with my daughter, be ready to wake up in the middle of the night for her, all that. So, you know, I had no time or energy for anything. And I remember, you know, there was a friend who had been here and there, had been sending me a few bucks here and there to help me out. And at one point he was like, oh, here is some money, but I don't want you to spend it for things you have to do, because those never end. There's always something. And, you know, I'll try to help you something with it, but I want you to do this for something you want to do. And I'm like, what the fuck are you even talking about, want to do? Yeah. There is no want to do in this space. There's nothing, you know? And then like at one point, I remember reading EQ, who was rather on friendly terms with sex workers, and thinking about, you know, there's no way for the foreseeable future that I'm ever going to hook up with anybody because I'm emotionally messed up. It would not be right for them. It would be, I would just be using them to be able to have like a moment of beauty through sexuality, through being with a hot woman. But it would be a messed up thing to do because I would feel that like I wouldn't be ready for a relationship. I wouldn't be ready for, I don't really like one night stands with the ambiguity about expectations and emotions that come into it. So I remember at some point of like, sex workers, how EQ doesn't make it sound sordid and gross the way most of society makes it sound. Is there such a thing, or is it all like nasty street prostitution, people desperate on crack kind of thing? And then, you know, doing my homework, I realized, no, there are many, many different things that go under the same label, but they are not the same thing at all. There are contexts where some of these ladies have a ton of autonomy, freedom. They run their own business. They choose their own client. They actually make bank. And I'm like, if it's not an abusive scenario, is there anything really bad with it? And I remember at one point I felt like, what the hell? What do I have to lose at this point? And I felt like pulling the trigger. And, you know, by the time I found myself there a little bit ahead of outside this lady's place, I was like, what the hell am I doing? This is so wrong. Not who I am. Not what I want. No, this sucks. I felt awful, right? But I'm like, I'm here. Let's find out. And I go in. And I meet this lady who was insanely nice. And I get it, that's her job, right? But that she was so insanely pleasant and sweet and nice. And again, one can say, okay, well, that's how she makes her money. That's how people want to keep going to see her because she makes them feel good. Not just through sex, but through the overall experience. But the weirdest thing was after it was all said and done, she... at one point, she asked me about me, about my life. And I'm like, I don't know that you want to know because it's heavy at this moment. But, you know, eventually I told her what was up. And she looked at me and she was like, don't pay me. And I'm like, what do you mean don't pay me? Of course I'll pay you. She's like, no, you need the money more than I do. I'm doing all right. And it's like, wow. And I'm like, and now we're having an argument in which I want to make sure she gets paid and she wants to make sure I don't. And I'm like, that was the sweet, like in a context that everybody think would be the most sordid, gross, weird contest where anybody's going to do whatever for 10 cents kind of thing. Having that degree of humanity with somebody that you're not going to meet again, you're not going to become best friends, is not going to be, you're just being really fucking nice to each other in the moment, in that hour to whatever you spend together, you are just super nice to each other and you actually genuinely care about each other, even though it's not going to go anywhere else. But finding that degree of kindness, of sweetness, just made me feel good about life, you know, made me feel good about humanity, made me feel good about life. So that was an interesting one.
Yeah, it sounds like a beautiful experience. It's weird. Because in society, we do accept many aspects of people paying for pleasure. You know, you can pay for booze, you can pay for all types of drugs, you can pay for massages, like whatever it is, you're exchanging money for something that brings you pleasure. But at least in America, we still have this puritanical sense of exchanging money for anything sexual is wrong and deviant, even though... you know, just like smoking a joint with a group of your best friends and having intensely passionate conversations, you know, you can have some sort of beautiful experience on the same level, sleeping with a beautiful woman or man or whoever it is. But there's like, we'd still have like some blockage when it comes to paying for sex, and the more that I think about it, like the more it doesn't make sense. Because I used to think that sex work was deviant or illegitimate, and I think it was just because of how I was raised and the Catholic Church and stuff like that. Like that wasn't even a question. If sex before marriage is wrong, sex outside of marriage is wrong, like paying for sex, like I'm going to three hells. Like I'll burn in the first hell and then my ashes will get dumped in the other two. But then I started to think about it, and paying for sex and from a worker who is willing and is great at her job and makes it a great experience for the person who's paying, that is one of the most honest forms of sex, one of the most honest interactions you could do. Because how many times do people, you know, fake, you know, like they take someone out to dinner, they'll pay $300 for dinner and they just want to get laid at the end of the dinner. So it's like this indirect transaction for sex, and maybe the girl feels pressured because this guy just dropped a shit ton of money and she's like, oh, well, now I have to do something, and the guy's expecting something, so you have the pressure with the expectation. Whereas you have a sex worker who's making a living, you give her the money, you know, she gives you her body, mind, you have a great time, and she makes a living, and you go back feeling satisfied, and that's that. So that's it sounds like a very, you know, beautiful experience, and I'm glad you got to experience that during a tough time.
Yeah, I think there are two things. Like the only thing that really bothers me in regard to sex work, and I think it's tied to the fact of it being illegal, is sometimes the abuse that characterizes much of it, not all of it. And I'm always glad to run into something that was not that stuff. You know, when there's all the pressure, exploitation, the drug abuse, you know, all of that stuff that essentially put people doing something that they don't want to do for money. That is, of course, terrible. Yeah. But just as much as that stuff exists, and, you know, we should do legally and in other ways, whatever is can be done to get rid of that aspect.
Yeah.
When it's, as you said, when it's willing, making good money, having choice on your clients, because, you know, you need to be able to have that kind of choice if it's something that's still even remotely healthy. I think then it can become something that is, how the hell is that different from getting a massage in that regard? And I do, precisely because I'm super sensitive to what you brought up, the games and pressures that exist in dating. It's like, I never, ever, ever want to play games with somebody's emotions, make them feel something because I want to get laid. And so that's why I'm saying certain things or doing certain things. Is essentially, I'm just trying to manipulate them into getting what I want. I never want to do that to anybody for any reason. So in that sense, that's where I feel a lot, like, to me, is way cleaner from an emotional standpoint to have transaction between both people who are willing and understand the beginning and the end of something, than having some mental game and manipulation. And I find that way more abusive and messed up and gross than being very upfront about it.
Yeah. And I listened to a podcast with a sex worker not too long ago, and this woman was saying that the best way to keep it clean and keep the abuse out of the sex work ecosystem is to legalize it, because 100%. It's something like smoking weed and a lot of other drugs. People are going to do it no matter what. People are going to pay for sex until the end of time. Making it illegal just makes it more dangerous for all parties involved. And so she was saying, this woman on the podcast was saying that one of the best things that you can do is make a list of clients that are abusive, and then that kind of goes around to all the sex workers, and they can be notified of a guy who has hit someone or is sketchy, something like that. But then a lot of these lists get taken offline because it's illegal. So like the cops will look at it and then arrest the sex workers that are in the forum. You know, you can't go to the police or anything like that. You can't say, I was having sex with a guy who paid me and he beat the shit out of me, like, because it's illegal.
No, 100%. And I think that's precisely the problem. That you got, are they drilling right outside your window now?
Yes. Yeah, there, do you hear that background noise? Is it too loud?
That one is getting pretty loud.
All right, I got them to stop for 10 minutes.
Great. I think what you were saying makes perfect sense. It's like the illegality of it is precisely what creates the problem because, it's like there should be security, there should be screening, there should be things that you can do only if it was legal in such a way that no person who ever decide to engage in sex work has to deal with the dangers, the violence, all that bullshit. It's like, hell no, none of the pimps, none of the abusive clients, none of the crap. And but of course, as you said, that can only happen in a situation where it's regulated and legalized, which, by the way, it's how it used to be. You know, it's like there was a time when in many places around the world, but even in US, where while technically legal, prostitution was for all intents and purposes legal. And it was, it's funny to see the statistics because the second they made it illegal, the rates of STDs skyrocketed. Because what would happen is that before, you would go regular medical checks. And sometime if you work for an establishment, they would pay to keep you well-fed while you got treatment. Of course, when you're on the street on your own and desperate, that's not the case. So rate of STDs going up, rate of violence against the sex workers went up, rate of all sort of crap happened. Because some people had to feel better about their own sense of morality and impose it on everyone else.
So speaking of violence, I saw that you had Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2 as a couple of your favorite films of all time, the suggested films on your website.
Sure.
And I waited too long to watch it, so I actually just watched it, probably 5 or 6 months ago. And I wanted to ask you, what makes Kill Bill a couple of your favorite pieces of cinema of all time? What kind of draws you to that, Quentin Tarantino masterpiece?
I think in that one, he hits all the right notes because sometimes Tarantino is, there are moments that are fantastic. The writing, it's surreal and hilarious, but maybe then he loses a step in the next scene. That one feels like it holds perfectly from beginning to end, from the soundtrack to the acting to the writing in particular. All of it clicks in a way that's both funny and powerful. And, it's kind of the perfect. Usually I tend to like Robert Rodriguez more, in that genre, Tarantino Rodriguez. There are more Rodriguez movies that I like even more, but that one, Kill Bill is just fantastic the way it's done.
Mm. So we mentioned before that you've spent time recording a bunch of conversations with comedians, guys like Bert Kreischer, Joe Rogan,
sure,
Duncan Trussell. And for someone that spends so much time talking to comedians, I'm assuming, you must find something fascinating about the comedian's mind and the way of looking at the world through the lens of humor. So what is it that you find meaningful about that way of thinking, the comedian's way of approaching life?
I think being able to laugh at things is essential, and it's a skill and it's a talent, because you can be a complete dick and just make jokes that are built just on putting people down, which can be funny, but you're still a dick at the end of the day. But there's a real talent about being funny in a way that takes the heaviness out of life, makes you feel more relaxed, makes you feel more refreshed, and not be a dick about it. And so think about like Duncan Trussell going off on like, somebody put together a whole series of his short design commercial. There's like a 3-hour video on YouTube on him just, these are commercials and they are the funniest thing the way he does them, that's genius. I love that. It's such a skill to be able to, like, sense of humor is really one of the most important skills that people can develop in life to make life more pleasant, more enjoyable, less heavy, be able to relax. So there's something beautiful about that when you're good at it. And then some people try and they're terrible at it, which is worse than if you had no humor at all.
Yeah. Yeah, there's I'm sure you've probably heard of Tim Dillon if you've been on podcasts with a bunch of other guys. Have you heard of Tim Dillon? So he has he's a stand-up comedian, and he has a podcast called The Tim Dillon Show. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite pieces of comedy of all time is his rant on his podcast about a woman who got shot in the face while shoveling snow. Like, she got shot multiple times while shoveling snow because she mouthed off to her neighbor, and her neighbor had a gun, and like this incredibly tragic thing happened where the neighbor shot her and her husband, and then the son ran away to get help. And I thought the same thing. I was like, because they mentioned the story, they're reading the story. And so I know the headline, I know it's about to happen. And I know Tim Dillon always pulls something out of it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to pretend to be able to do that now, because he's so fucking good at what he does. He's one of the best in the world. But that was so terrible. And he, by the end of the rant, had me cackling in my apartment. And the premise of the story was a woman got brutally murdered. And I'm just like, there's a magic. Mm-hmm. And the only thing he's doing, like, he's saying words in a sequence with certain emotions, emphasizing certain words, saying them slowly, saying them faster, louder. But like at the end of the day, it's wordplay and the way you're able to stream thoughts together. And the way he does it made me laugh at one of the most horrific situations that, you know, I've ever heard described on a podcast, a stand-up comedian's podcast, not counting history podcasts, because there are a lot more worse things that happen. But being able to laugh at that 5 minutes.
Yeah.
I'm just looking at the guy through the window. Thank you. But yeah, being able to laugh at something, being able to conjure up like that reaction of laughter through something so tragic, there is a magic to it. And it's a skill that's built over time. But the best guys that do it, like Tim Dillon, Duncan Trussell, Joe Rogan, they've done so many reps where it just seems natural and they're telling a story. And they're making you laugh at something that you never thought you would, which is, to me, why comedy is such a release.
Yeah, and I think it's key because there are so many others who try to do that thing, and all they do is, in the name of being edgy, just being complete dicks, and they're like, what? I'm a comedian. This is a joke. And it's like, no, you're just a dick, and I'm funny dick at that. So the result is what makes all the difference. It's like, it's not necessarily the topic you tackle, but how you do it.
Yeah.
One person will do it and be really obnoxious, and one person will do it and somehow transform something horrible into something that you can actually relax about.
Yeah.
It's a skill. You know, it's a skill. It's like when Roberto Benigni, when he did, what was that movie, Life is Beautiful? You know, the premise of that, making a funny movie about the Holocaust, is not the most popular, but he pulled it off. You know, Jewish organizations all over loved it and thought he was brilliant. So it's like, if the people who are the ones suffering on a situation feel that you did a fantastic job while actually doing something funny about that situation, that's when you know you won. Mm. If you didn't pull that off, then you got a problem on your hands.
Mm. To end off, what do you think happens after we die?
Who knows? I mean, it's one of the big ones, right? It's like, nobody knows, of course. I've seen enough weird shit in my life to make me think that the physical world is all that there is to it. But of course, you know, those are little snippets of things that make you go, huh, I think there's more to it. But that's all there is. Because ultimately, nobody.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Daniele. I'm getting the signal from the construction workers in the window that they got to start drilling again, but they were kind enough to hold off for a few minutes to let us finish the conversation. So that's amazing. And thank you again so much for your time. This was a blast, and I enjoy going through your work. History on Fire. You have the Drunken Taoist podcast. Is there anything else you'd like to direct people towards before we end off?
No, that's it. That's perfect.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This it was great. I'll talk to you soon.
Have a good one.